Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm very excited to have this discussion with you. Took a look at your profile, and as I mentioned to you earlier, you have had quite an illustrious career. I think you've, mentioned that it's kind of a interesting path that unfolds. You never know where life's going to take you and how the dots will connect, but you've definitely worked with some really interesting organizations. I think you've cut your teeth in the green sprain space, as you mentioned. So I'm looking forward to unpacking your thought leadership around, ESG, around the green economy, and around your corporate knowledge in general. I think, there's a lot of challenges that corporates face in today's world. I think it's a perfect storm of challenges for any C-suite at the moment. There's a myriad of challenges across not just ESG, but tech adoption, frank and stack, leadership. So I'm pretty sure you can provide a few pearls of wisdom around that. And yeah, I'm just very grateful that you had to share your thoughts. Maybe you can give a bit of background, who you are and what it is that you do currently.
Well, firstly, I want to say thank you very much for inviting me. It was one of those, wow, this is going to be interesting. I reserve the right to ask you a few questions in the process.
Always.
Okay, excellent, good. And so I ran my first $10 million business at 23.
Wow.
It was kind of wow. Of course, I had no idea what I was stepping into, as you don't at
It's probably
23.
called a deep end.
Well, it was the deep end on a couple of levels. It was a $10 million business. And then when I got in there, I discovered that we had $1 million of unfunded debt
Okay.
and that we'd been running in the red for 10 years.
Okay, so how you postured the 10 million was creative.
Clearly there was a little bit of a lot more was being, more was being spent than was coming in. And that was, I can't say it was a trial by fire, but it was certainly one of those ones of really having to learn the fundamentals about what keeps a business afloat and alive, like sustainability 101, in a live environment. It wasn't theory. It was, we had,
You're not in the business school.
no,
You're
no, no, I don't,
dealing with the reality of life.
it wasn't case studies or, where
Jobs on the
somebody's
line.
selected a whole bunch of data, and given you it nicely packaged up. It was live. There were employees to look after. There are all the people that we had, that were, the customers. There were the other suppliers and the other parts. We were one of the biggest businesses in the state. In fact, we're possibly the biggest business in the state. We're certainly up there in the top handful.
And when you say states, is this in
I was
Australia?
yes, this was in Australia. This was in Tasmania.
How did you, if I may just pause you there, how did you step into such a big role at such a young age? What preluded that? Your university or
I'm going to say naivety and innocence.
guaranteed.
So I was made treasurer of the student union and the board of management. And in those days, the student services were run by the students.
Okay.
So we had the bar, the refectory.
What university is this?
This was the University of Tasmania.
Okay.
Refectory, a 264-bed housing scheme, the library, the bookstore, it just like we ran it all. And I think people pretty much gone all their students. It doesn't really matter, providing they're not losing too much money.
So they actually put the student body in charge of
Well,
all
the
of the
student body
OpEx?
had developed them over the years, you see. So we're
Okay.
going back quite a way. So back in the day, there were student services didn't exist. So the student union had started providing them. So we had a board of management that actually ran the business side, and then we had the union, which ran the student politics, as it were. But basically, when you became secretary, treasurer, or president, you were across both bodies.
Okay.
So,
Great learning experience.
amazing. I mean, amazing learning experience, because I was doing economics and law. In the theory of it, studying it, and then I become treasurer, and I look at this and I go, like, but we've just gone and built this absolutely the biggest entertainment venue at the time in the state. Well, where's this money coming from? And having enough of a business background, and how, what, where we, how are we repaying it? To find out there was absolutely no agreement with the people who provided the funds on how this was going to happen.
I feel like that's a common theme in today's world. No one's asking that question when it's like the US is giving this much money to this country. I'm like, where is the money coming from and who is actually paying for it? So I want to loop back to that later, but please continue with your story.
And having lived, as we were talking about earlier, in some interesting places where the country level debt is, you know, seeing what happens and doesn't happen on that one. And so one of my very earliest things was recognizing this and then going, I know that I'm not the first treasurer or president to have responsibility for this, but I can't ignore it and just pretend. And which led to all sorts of things, including having to, you know, have some pretty deep and direct conversations with some of the people being part of creating it and letting it run. And I'm going like, just because we're students doesn't make us incompetent.
Mm. So you picked up high degrees of incompetence in the financial construct or to manage those assets?
Yeah. Well, it was just people going, well, it's not important to us. We don't care. No one's paying attention, so we're not paying attention.
Interesting. Where was the money coming from?
So what was happening was, in essence, the university was underwriting things, except going like, oh, well, you know, they're not creating too many problems. And I was looking at it, and I'm going, but we've still got $1 million of unfunded debt. And if you own the debt, and you can call it, I don't want us subject to the game that gets played if you don't have a clean agreement.
Mm.
It's much cleaner to have an agreement that is like, you know, we do this, we commit to paying on these sorts of terms, and this is how we'd renegotiate if we had issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the funniest piece was, so people are going, but you can't take this to the students, they can't cope. So I ran the first positive budget in over a decade. So we actually broke even for the first time in 10 years, negotiated with the university to get an agreement on how we'd repay it, had that all factored in. And everyone was going like, Joanne, you're never going to get reelected. And I did. And to me, it was one of those absolutely amazing things that I look back now on, you know, the intervening years in between, was what I took out of that was that when we treat other people as adults, what a shocking idea, they actually act like an adult. So instead of talking to my, you know, fellow students as if they were idiots and couldn't understand a basic budget, it was like, well, this is what's happening. This is where it's at. This is why what I want to do, yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we want to look like a bunch of incompetent students because we don't need to?
Mm.
And it was like, do it. So we had to do all the tough things that it took. You know, there were some people who were let go because they hadn't been delivering their part of what was promised, you know, which was part of why there were losses. It took changing the services and what we could provide, given how much money that was really. So all that, you know, what these days they call stakeholder management, stakeholder and the multi-stakeholder thing, all that was living Petri dish. But we treated each other as adults and capable of finding a constructive outcome, and we did. And I got voted back in again. Like,
it's
there you go.
Interesting listening to you unpack this, because I've spent the last 2 years going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, which has made me get to grips with Austrian economics, economics in general, the woo-woo economics that exist in the world today.
Yeah.
The debt that exists and how money is printed and how we decoupled from the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gone down all of that. And as I'm listening to you speak, it feels like you should step into some government roles and help some of the governments that are raising debt ceilings and just printing money and not asking the questions about where's the money coming from, because it seems like that is a perpetual story that is in motion, which is no one really deep dives, and I wonder what the psychology is behind it. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts, but it tends to be something that, I mean, it's, first of all, you're in a university, so this should be where you grounding and dealing with the fundamentals of economics.
Yeah.
The fact that it took you to come in as a student to actually rectify that, where were the adults in the room, number one? And then number two is, why is this such a prevalent problem? And is this the reason that the world economy is at the moment on the brink of collapse? Oh, no.
Is that a battery that's going?
That is a camera that is deciding not to play along. Give me one sec. Not sure that's why you're really misbehaving. Yeah,
that is so funny.
should be.
I'm impressed that it can do that all on its little lonesome.
You're right. Let's go there. Okay. Hopefully it doesn't do it again. I'm not sure why. It's fully charged and good to go. Okay. Sorry about that. So just, I mean, fantastic grinding for you, right?
Yeah.
Entering into the real world.
I mean, absolutely. The most fundamental piece of, in some way or other, we support and look at you. We support, when someone gives you a loan, there's an implicit value exchange, not necessarily in the immediate time, but over some kind of time. Mm. And when I went to the university, and I remember sitting down with the, you know, then vice chancellor, you know, who's, you know, expecting the students to come in and basically go, oh, you know, we need more money.
Mm.
The last conversation that he and the treasurer expected was me going, well, okay, I realize there's this thing. It's a bit of an issue because I don't want you guys to be at risk for not having a repayment plan. It's significant. Neither do I want us. So how are we going to work one out?
Interesting.
And because we then, once we had done that, we were on adult to adult terms with them. You see, you're really not sure that this is a good idea to talk about.
Yeah, it's like giving us a
Us a signal. It's
kind of like, yeah, let's just see why it's overheating. Okay, it's fine. We just take you out of the game. You do like this.
Oh, it's the stand that's having the problem, is it?
I think it's just overheating. It's like enough for one day. There we go.
Okay.
This is the part where the phone decides to fall over at some point. It's okay.
At which point we'll just laugh and go, okay, so this, you know, there's some contextual spirit. Some of Adam Smith's animal spirits are appearing.
It's the central bank. The central bank's getting involved before we say too much.
Exactly, going, don't.
Okay, so you went into the chancellor's office and surprised him with some logical thinking around financials.
Yeah.
Okay, amazing. So that was your genesis.
So that was the genesis. And so by the time I went to growing up work, which my first proper official corporate job was with Anderson Consulting, what's now Accenture. And it had turned out that I'd run a bigger practice than any of the partners.
Oh, really?
They found that very, very uncomfortable to have, you know, a female be an awful lot younger and see a lot shorter.
Yeah.
It didn't fit their idea of how, you know, where wisdom was meant to be coming from. But I'd run a business, you know, a $10 million business back in those days was quite a significant size business. And so I ended up being roped into doing a couple of executive projects to help them on their business management.
So you always found that you just had a knack to come in, look at the nitty gritty, restructure to turn a business into a profitable entity.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
You would think that wouldn't be so difficult, but that really is, right?
Well, I mean, this is the funny thing. You probably may have similar experiences. Sometimes you just things that you just do and for whatever bundle of life reasons you've picked up the skills for. Mm. And it just struck me as normal.
Mm. Were you like that, if I may inquire, in your childhood with your own pocket money? Did you see the trend starting there already, or were you the kid that actually saved their money?
Well, actually, more of it was, so we lived in Nigeria when I was a kid. And I distinctly remember being given, you know, 10 naira, which, you know, back in the day, 10 naira was like real serious money. You know, 10 naira as a kid was like, whoa. And yeah, that was great. And then the currency collapsed.
Mm.
And I was most distraught because my 10 naira did not buy anything nearly as much when I went somewhere else in the world.
Mm.
And then a similar thing happened.
Did you dive into white collapse? Did you scratch the surface?
Oh, yeah. Well, my father was an agricultural economist. So talking about economics and systems and how things interact was dinner conversation.
Nice.
So it was part and parcel of, you know, what was happening and then where the causality. Yeah, and what's behind it. And then, you know, where and how does one take action to manage one's way, you know, through that. And so when you have, you know, be it inflation with, or deflation or, you know, currency variations or collapses, which I, and so when I ended up in Thailand with PricewaterhouseCoopers, managing financial services consulting there, you know, 25 years later on, I remember phoning my mom at one stage and going, "Mom, this is happening. And then this is happening." And she's going, "Well, what do you think is going to happen next?" I said, "The currency is going to devalue lots." She goes, "Well, you've seen it before."
Mm.
And then about 3 weeks later, yeah, we lost 25% on the baht.
So what I'm picking up, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I suspect, because you mentioned earlier that your dad was a scientist.
Yeah.
And it seems like he spent a lot of time unpacking the realities of life and drawing logical deductions from systems, processes, triggers, causalities. So that naturally became ingrained in your outlook on life, which empowered you with this natural ability to come into complex financial ecosystems and to start understanding the intricacies and parallels or links between the different inflows, outflows, and made it quite simple for you.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
And it's because, I mean, do you have things in your own childhood like that where you picked up like a knowledge set or a thinking system that you've then found later on isn't as common as you thought? Like, I just thought it was normal because that was the world I was in. It was only when I went elsewhere I realized it wasn't normal.
Mine was resilience. Resilience.
Okay. Being,
because we're quite a big family, long story short, had to go to boarding school and developed quite a thick skin early on. And I think that served me well in my adulthood with a lot of the challenges I've had to face and my never say die attitude when I take on a specific task, venture, or role.
Mm.
So the only one that pops to mind as you ask the question is resilience. I'm sure there's something else. It wasn't financial, I can guarantee you that much. I didn't have that. Yeah. I haven't understood financial or economics in general was for me not of interest or even a black art because it just didn't make sense until I started studying Bitcoin. Until I started going down that rabbit hole, do I feel like I actually can make some informed thinking and logic as to why we're having these repetitive cycles that are unfolding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you take what you're seeing on the economics and you add the resilience in, because to me, that's a super powerful life skill.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, so when you put those two together, you know, what comes up for you? What do you see happening?
Well, I would say the financial part, I've become very, very careful in storing my value. I'm resilient in pushing through in entrepreneurial activities. Mm-hmm. My financial side has become a low time preference way of living versus a high time preference way of living. But that's only recent in the last 2 to 3 years, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. But the resilience has been there since childhood. So that has got me through the journey of life.
And
I'm looking forward to what the next 10 years has to hold because I think I'm going to need both financial and resilience. I'm glad I'm stacking sats.
Well, and this is the piece, is these different components. So, like, one of the things I've noticed in my life was that because we'd live places where the economy did change so hugely and so unpredictably, there's a certain appreciation that who we are and who we wanted to show up with actually had absolutely nothing to do with the economics. It had absolutely everything to do with the choice we made in the moment.
Correct. Correct. Mm. Yeah. I saw a tweet from someone that I don't know about a day ago who went and attended a billionaires conference. So having guys on stage giving some of these usual golden nuggets or pulls of wisdom. And what stuck with me about his tweet was that one or two tweaks in his logic at a younger age would have resulted in a lot more zeros behind his name, you know, and it kind of resonated because we can very easily make stupid decisions that cost us dearly without even realizing it while we're going through it. And only later on in life do you realize not leveraging the, what do they call it? Eighth wonder of the world, compound interest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, you know, like financial, I'm talking through the financial lens now. So, I'm intrigued to understand your thinking more, and you know, just looping back to the Thailand story. So, what were the soft signals that you picked up at that point, if you can remember, that made you predict that kind of slide? And how did you manage it? Did you keep it to yourself, or was it a company-wide thing that you made available and pivoted or prepared for?
Well, it was one of those weird ones. Sometimes when you know too much, people aren't sure they want to listen.
Oh, yes.
And so, you know, one of the signals I'd picked up was that when a country starts putting in currency controls, that is a very strong signal because it means inflows or outflows are too big. And so currency controls came in.
And for those that don't know what a currency control is, what would that typically look like?
For example, most of the time, if we want to send money anywhere around the world, we just go send it. Currency controls came in and were saying that we could only send anything above this amount needed to be approved.
Okay.
You know, so basically that was acts as a choke on flow.
Red flag.
Yeah. That's definitely a, in the same way in business, when the finance says,
no more coffee.
Well, you know, no more coffee. It's sort of like, excellent. You know.
That's worst case scenario. Then you know you're right at the end.
Well, exactly. But this is it. You know, there are signals that really are ones that life experience. So that was the currency ones, like in business, when a CFO goes, okay, you know, you're meant to be running a multi-billion dollar business, but we're only going to let you, you're going to have to get your finance guy to countersign $10,000. Like that's a choke.
Yeah.
It's a choke. And it's a signal that there's something intrinsically not right going on. And when once then you have learned, you know, you parse down onto what's behind it. So that was, you know, that was an absolutely big one. And then that was sort of like the major signal. And then there was one other one. I know that there was two that I was looking at. I'm trying to think of what the second one was. And it could have just been something as practical as credit terms were getting pushed out, payments were getting pushed out. It could have just been like those two, that business cycle cash stretching a little bit, going like, okay, warning signal from a business point of view. But the currency one was like, okay, looking at this. And then what happened was that, when this was the Asian financial crisis, and Thailand was the country that was most heavily hit. And so we lost 25% in a couple of days, which is quite a lot.
That's massive. I mean,
yeah,
that's disastrous for some, depending how, I think, overextended you are, right?
Well, the big challenge becomes if you've got debts denominated in another currency,
yes,
or cash or inflows denominated in another currency, depending on whether it goes up or down, one's either making or losing or having to source. And, you know, that from a lot of finance is a flow. And that essentially changes the pipes and what can come through and how much needs to go through. And my challenge was that I was running the financial services consulting practice.
Okay.
And so if there was anyone who should be spotting it, yeah, it was me. But then the challenge came to go to the rest of the partnership and go, here are the signals. How do we prepare?
And did you?
The crisis happens was one of those ones, like many crises, slowly, 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 and then all suddenly, at once.
Yeah.
When the all at once hit, which is where, you know, other learning from childhood became super helpful. And that was that you find your partners to look after each other. Mm. Because when you've got that kind of thing happening economically, no one's business is stable. Most businesses will not have sat down and modeled what will happen if you have that kind of shock going through the system. More will now because we've got more sophisticated tools. But even then, you have to be comfortable to put that scenario on the table to go, well, what happens? I mean, I had friends who grew up in Zimbabwe, which was, you know what happened there. And I remember sitting down with him and myself, because we'd both dealt with massive currency shifts and inflations and things like that. You know, we're going like, oh yeah, our personal financial models are, we're able to stick it in and go, oof, therefore, this is what else we might be wanting to do. Mm. And so I was doing that in business. And I remember distinctly upsetting some of the other partners. Oh, Joanne, you're being difficult. And I'm going, no. I said, if I wasn't saying this, I should not be in my leadership position because my industry is finance.
Yeah.
No, okay. So, you know, you guys are dealing with other industries. You know, pay attention to different issues.
Yeah, you should be listening because this is going to permeate across to you one way or another, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you think humans don't want to face the bad news? It seems like a consistent trend, especially with finances, right? I look at the world today. We have a systemic financial crisis that is about to hit the world, okay? It's already started unfolding with the defaults of various banks across the U.S. There's this propping up of the global financial system, you know, through woo-woo economics is what I like to call it. But no one is really addressing it. 2008 was disastrous. The world almost stopped. What's about to happen will make 2008 look like a sandpit in comparison. So why is it that we are avoiding the obvious? Why is it not on every major front newspaper? Why is it brushed under the carpet, or is it brushed under the carpet? You know, is there this consistent human trend of playing Monopoly and not wanting to ever deal with the reality of the worst case scenario? We kind of want to avoid the bad news, right?
I think there's a couple of pieces that come into it. I suspect those of us who've lived through the disaster scenarios before are comfortable in looking at them simply because we realize we've lived through them.
Do you think we've learned?
I suspect we apply at least in our personal.
Yeah.
In the personal.
How we diversify our risk maybe.
Yeah. And then what base do I put on in my life? So one of the pieces that I personally target out is I try and keep my debt levels low. And, you know, I know the wonderful powers of leverage, but that cuts both ways. And having sat down and modeled what happens when you have portfolios doing a 20, 30% shift, which they do every couple of years, and then you model out what that does to leverage and how quickly you can get wiped out, there's got to be an absolutely massive buffer to go like, okay.
And that's what you've seen with the banks, right?
Yeah.
It's a simple... in my mind, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but my layman understanding is the banks have taken long-term leverage in the form of bonds, which are meant to be the stablest form of investment, low return, low risk. The Fed and the banks have been printing money, the central banks, okay, to combat the inflation. They have to raise the interest rates, which corners all the banks, and all of a sudden their whole portfolio is flipped on them. And to your point, every basis point that is going up in the wrong direction is making them illiquid and basically putting them in the red, and hence they're starting to shut down.
Yeah.
So they've basically checkmated themselves for an oversimplification of a very complex scenario.
Well, what's been happening is an advanced game of chicken. So that dynamic that you just described is something that, people suss out. And when they started pumping the first rounds of quantitative easing in the global financial crisis, the question was, well, when's the inflation going to hit?
Yeah. Right.
And it's like, wait a second, it's not showing up yet. What fundamentally happened was an awful lot of that inflated denominated money, instead of showing up in price inflation, ended up in the speculative investments. Where on earth did all the VC money come from?
Yeah.
You know, in essence, it's going like, you know, one level money.
The stock market, VCs.
Yeah, it floated off into.
To the 1% that's all connected.
Yeah, into this other world. So we didn't end up with kind of inflation. When you looked about how much money was put in as a ratio, we should have seen much more inflation. But we didn't. It's because it moved into a different, different shell game. And, you know, that shell game's been very entertaining because lots of stuff is moving around and, you know, different people, you know, then a bit of money leaks back into, you know, other, you know, the other economy. And it's like, well, there's actually all these little parallel ones playing along. And, you know, I use the phrase a game of chicken because the dynamic that you're calling out of at when does the House of Cards collapse?
Yes.
Is people going, well, I reckon I can do another cycle. I can do another cycle of the money game. I can do another cycle of the VC game before it collapses.
So this comes back down to human greed, in essence. It's the same perpetual human greed at all cost scenario, which is just daunting, right? Because the consequence is severe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's baseline back because, I mean, I could talk to you for hours and go down that rabbit hole, but I want to just pull it back to the work that you're currently doing. So you've got this clear capability that has served you well in your career, helping companies and consulting companies to manage finances and to do it in a way that ensures sustainability. What is the crux of what you currently do, and maybe share a bit of your current work and how you serving industry?
Well, what happened was, because this is sort of like we're saying, sometimes it's the loops of life that make the difference. I was asked to help a significant fund look at what their strategy was. So it was, you know, that was the finance and business brain was the one that had been asked in the room. But they had a particular remit that had a high sustainability requirement on it. And so they weren't looking for me to have any understanding of that because I was in on the business strategy. And it's funny how these two worlds are considered totally apart. And when I was working through the strategy, I was asking questions about, well, okay, well, what's your mandate? How are you going to actually demonstrate and prove that? Because that's actually how you verify what you're actually doing for the next cycle. And I was pulling apart some of the top line statements. And the CEO ends up going like, you understand this stuff more than half of our people do, but you're a business strategist, you know, you're money brain, not this, how? And that looped me back to the dinner table conversations I'd had as a kid, because my father was a senior scientist and, you know, part of the initial research groups around what's now the Green Revolution. So the environmental and social sustainability type issues, the decision-making things that are really corporate governance, that was dinner table conversation. You know, when you're working out, anyhow, not the time for some good Nigerian scam stories right now. They've been doing that for a really long time, let me just say.
Good at it as well.
They're very good. They're very good. It was happening when I was a kid, so there's plenty of experience on it. But all the things that we now call ESG, environment, social, and governance, were all part and parcel of how do you create, when we want to introduce something new into an environment, and in this case, my dad's case, it was farms in different parts of Africa and different parts of Asia, the two primary places that he would work in. How will it create, and there's two key criteria that they would evaluate success on. One was economically, would it actually add value into the farm? So, you know, the equivalent of the business side. But the second one was the one that was, how will it help the farm and the family, the community, be able to be more prosperous for longer? So doing something that was a great short-term hit that might create one successful crop, but create a damage that meant that farm was not going to be able to prosper and have crops in subsequent season, was just, excuse the expression, I'm Australian, bloody stupid.
And you have full license to be.
Okay.
South African and Australian in a room, let's go.
Okay, off we go. You know, I mean, it was just, you know, was that just considered absolutely stupid? That is not a sustainable farm to do things like that. So that fundamental thinking on, if you're doing things and that's going to create pressures between you as the farmer and your farm workers, because you know, most farms, even if they're small family holdings, will have people that come in from other ones, or if they're bigger ones, of course, and they have direct employees. That creates a huge thing. You add another $100 a year into a small farmer's income. Quite often, what that would do would mean that a daughter would get put into school.
Yeah.
There was just a little extra margin.
Like ratios between inputs and outputs for small things, like even just land ownership and what that does within an economy, right?
Exactly.
To give someone actual ownership versus a gray area and how they could fundamentally change an entire landscape.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
And so that was, you know, that awareness of there was far more, if to create something that's successful in the long run, you know, and I'm going like long run, a couple of years, you know, and I've been around in business long enough to go long run, actually a couple of decades. I know how long it takes. I know how long it takes to get a business really up on its feet and truly living and prosperous and profitable so that it actually lasts. It takes a decade.
Easy,
it's a lot of work. So why on earth would one want to be investing time and energy without that intention of, A, building it for the decade, which means thinking about what will happen if I do this now, how will that show up over a couple of cycles?
We do think very short term with our, I mean, I deal with a lot of startups. Yeah. I don't think I think everyone kind of wants to see this 5-year unicorn scale up exit, living the dream scenario. Yeah.
And it's, you know, by all means, you know, I love living the dream and the theory of it. But this is where it then gets back into, and what's the real data? Nearly everyone I've ever spoken to over, you know, what's now an extended business career, and you go and talk to them, and you sound like, oh my God, you know, you're an overnight success. Nearly everyone, you get that little smile on the face and said, yeah, over the decade. I mean, it just is. And so this idea that we in the startup space, and so I know when I've been in mentoring in that space, it's like, nah, if you're playing a 2-year game, don't waste your time.
Yeah.
You know, if you're playing a 4-year game, yeah. You know, if you're playing a 10-year game, over a 10-year game, your odds of success are pretty good, if nothing else, because most people do not have the guts to commit to the decade.
That long-term thinking.
Yeah. And the thing is, the decade feels daunting because it is a decade. But it's also what separates, you know, the wannabes from those that actually genuinely do.
Okay. Agreed. I couldn't agree more, and I've been hearing a lot of this in some of the content I've been absorbing recently. You know, these visionaries that are thinking long term, and how that fundamentally changes the culture and ecosystem for a company through that type of strategic thinking. So the work you do centered around that.
Yep. So it's centered around what do we need to do now, so that our 3, 5, 10 year has its best chances of success. And we've deliberately worked with the construct of ESG, of environment, social, and governance, because it's the most accepted construct where we're getting away from saying that the main metric is money. You know, finances is an absolutely critical and key metric. I mean, what we're talking about before, but it doesn't stay alive and in action unless we go and look after these other things. And in looking after these other things, what I've seen over the years is that we identify new opportunities. We identify different ways of doing things that allows us to either serve our customers better or find efficiencies that we wouldn't otherwise do, or tap on talents that we didn't realize we had within the organization, or collaborate in ways that the traditional competitive model is not very good at. And so much more now of the success is coming from is how do we create dynamics that means you're putting something, I mean, like, take this, for example. We're both putting in the time and attention for a conversation that we both find interesting, and trust that the people who choose to spend the time listening to us and companionship find it interesting too. It's a collaborative creation that is bigger than any one of us sitting here alone. And this is equally true in business when we're looking at going, okay, if we're here now, and this is where, you know, I literally talk about, okay, you want to be a unicorn. What's the point of the horn?
Oh, nice. I like that.
What's the point of the horn?
May I take that and license it?
You may. You may take it and license it. And therefore, what are the iterations we're going to need that's going to help us get towards that point? Gotcha. Because it isn't one that, you know, that those lovely diagrams that we have in PowerPoint, the straight line.
The hockey stick.
Oh, even better. I love the hockey stick. And it's like, oh. And it's like, nah, there'll be a whole bunch of like wiggles and backs and forth. You know, there'll be the moments of drama. And getting through the hockey stick is, there's so many different ways of doing that that aren't necessarily about masses of debt. Like, I actually think the sooner a business is able to demonstrate that people will actually value and pay, like the one, if you go like, if this is the point of your horn, the sooner you find ways that people actually will value it, the more likely you're to get there. The great thing is we've got, with the current tools that we have and the way that digitization helps us, it's so much easier to connect and actually do that than it used to be. Like, I remember when I first went up to Thailand, I literally was, I was given, my Australian would say I nicked, but it was actually with permission. you know, the laptop, you know, the remember the bricks? because they were so scarce back then. They just weren't done. And now my phone has more brains than my laptop.
Yeah.
And that just gives us data and access in ways that we didn't have. And so when I'm working with, it's usually the leadership teams that I work with, because what I found is that if the leaders aren't, the leadership team, and particularly the CEO and the chairman, or if it's a smaller organization, the main investors, if they're not prepared to go and stay a course, like when I start talking a decade and the different sorts of swings and arrows of outrageous force, if they wince on that, I know what the probability of success is, about zero.
Wow. Interesting.
I mean,
relevant to some of the stuff I'm busy doing that I'll share more with now.
Yeah.
But everyone's always so focused on the founder or the founding team, but it's broader than that based on what you're saying.
Yeah. Because it used to be about the one hero, the founder, and then, people got a bit wiser and go like, the team is pretty important. Then it's the culture on how are you going to swap people in and out as the organization shifts and grows? Because it's a different...
The team that took you from 1 to 10, 10 to 50, and 50 to 100 are all fundamentally different.
Exactly. Very different psyches, very different life experiences and professional experiences that do it. Totally different risk profiles. And then the finance and the money journey that goes along with it, because who's putting that in and how's that operating? That's sort of what I've often found is the unspoken one. So a whole pile of the focus is, so who are we actually being? So the leadership, the culture, the values. But then equally is then how are we playing the money game on that one? And how, your phrase of resilience is so key in this one. How will it last and respond when the shit hits the fan?
Mm.
Like we're just saying, like when we look at what's could easily be coming up in the next, not to be a doom and gloomist, but I have seen currencies collapse more than once.
Yeah.
I remember, have you come across the phrase Minsky collapse?
No.
Okay. It's a fabulous old fashioned economics phrase that I learned way back in the day. And I remember sort of hearing about this phrase Minsky collapse and going, oh, that's what happened when when I was a kid and all the banks collapsed. So basically what it is that when we lose trust in our finance system, we go, there's an equivalent of a run for the money. You want to try and pull, it's not there, and the system collapses.
You realize that the whole thing's a farce.
Well, it's a trust game.
Yeah.
I mean, fundamentally, banking and finance and insurance, and asset management, the finance system is a trust game. And so a lot of the processes, the regulatory processes are about how do we try and maintain enough good behavior to the greed stuff you were talking about, and it's certainly out there. How do we maintain enough rules in it so that we can actually continue to trust that the cards aren't going to collapse? Because so like one of the questions I'd be working with through people now is like, so how are you actually designing the organization and the relationships so that when some kind of turmoil comes, because it's pretty likely, I don't know exactly which one, but the odds of some significant turmoil are pretty high, how on earth would we get through it or not? Or how do we close shop gracefully?
Well, I think
it's resilience.
More of it's resilience, but I want to... I think resilience is not going to work anymore because there's a perfect storm of challenges that every business faces and every individual faces at a home environment. And the one thing that keeps coming to my mind is business continuity or futurist thinking or red flag, blue flag, right? So soft signals that lead up to a black swan event and being able to make sure that your business continuity and strategies are intact to deal for worst case scenario, 2008, no one was prepared, even though the writing was on the wall. In retrospect, it was pretty obvious, you know, on how bonds were being repackaged to show a better credit rating than they actually had, and the shenanigans there. No lessons learned, no accountability. All those people moved into different positions in different banks, and here we are dealing with a very similar outlook that's exponentially larger. COVID, again, just showed how unprepared the world is at every level for black swan events. A ship getting stuck in the Suez Canal, again, everything comes to a grinding halt.
Look at the Panama Canal right now is slowed down.
So, you know, the reason this resonates so much with me, this discussion, is I have just recently finished building some consulting tools that I'm using because I've now spent the last year and a half deep diving into the startup ecosystem. So my first three startup businesses completely failed, was just fumbling my way through it. Great ideas, no framework, no strategy, no mentorship, just raw kind of tenacity, resilience. Let's go. I believe in this. Give me my pension money. Let me go build something. And kind of went to school on that one. The third one ran it for 5.5 years, still made some schoolboy errors and ended up impacting, you know, like 9 different people because I had to eventually, they just left because I didn't want to retrench anyone, eventually couldn't pay anyone. And the whole thing came crumbling down, death of the ego, boom, done. Ended up going back into corporate, working and scaling a startup through there. Now I've left there and I'm in a startup ecosystem, but I keep seeing the same patterns. So I'm wiser. I've cut my teeth. I've got the battle scars. And I'm looking and I'm working with the startups and I'm working with the ecosystem. And whether I'm talking to a startup, a VC, an incubator, accelerator, yes, there are elements or pockets of excellence on how to do things better. But I still see the same learning curves being kind of repeated. So what have I done? I've now spent the last 6 months building out a VC assessment tool, which measures the startup against their business dimension, the market validation, future readiness, and technology. Each of those has a whole list of questions underneath it, which gives me these beautiful charts that show me how ready are you to be invested in, measuring them against those different dimensions and scoring with weighted scores that can be tweaked to meet a VC requirements. And I've done the same thing with the technology assessment. And then most importantly, the build to last assessment, which is looking at what is your ability strategically to sell, build, and run, to scale that, to then have the skills to support that. And for the first time, I feel like I've got something that baselines the startup that you can mentor against, identify where the gaps are, and have some level of methodology or data to quantify preparedness, risk, and ability to scale. Because why we need that is you can't just take a startup and airdrop it into a Huawei or an enterprise partner of Huawei and hope for the best. Are they ready? Can they even deal with a big corporate PwC opportunity, you know? So anyway, just looping back to your point, this really resonates quite a lot when it comes to identifying soft signals and making sure that you're prepared as an organization to actually deal, to turn, are those soft signals going to be leading to a black swan event, and how prepared are you to deal with that? Supply chain, business continuity. Do you have visibility over your assets? If the world comes to a grinding halt and everyone has to stay at home for the next 2 years again, how ready are you to manage all your assets? So, you know, these things really resonate. I don't think everyone's learned their lesson. COVID shone a light on it, and we see a spike in digitalization strategies. So I think the work you do is really kind of very important.
I think both of these things are important because people put so much time and energy in. And the number of people in the startup space that are, in essence, pulling out of pensions, you know, and or credit cards and or
getting into debt, getting family into debt.
And it just
on pure gut, right?
Yeah, and it's to have something that goes, okay, you want to, but how do you actually manage this risk profile so that you're setting yourself up for the best chances of success?
Yes.
And like one of the things, so, you know, when we set up the ESG Institute, which is a separate organization, you know, part of the gap there was going, massive gap in green skills, massive gap in green leadership.
Mm.
And most people are focusing in on the tech.
Mm.
But human decision-making is still part of the solutioning. And people are going like, well, how can you scale it? And it's like, well, we've scaled global transformations across 50 odd countries and been able to do that in 6 months. This is fundamentally no different. These days, that the tools and techniques to be able to do that kind of scaling exist in quite a different way to the way that it did in the past. But one of the pieces I want to loop back in is when you look at that ability for organizations to leap, I'm going to use the expression leap because it's not, sometimes it is, as you say, you have something that a huge organization goes, you've got something a little different there. And that could be helpful at ours. What signals have you found that are like the soft signals for an organization or a team to be able to step into that leap?
Good question. 95% of the time when I work with my startups, before I even get to them leaping into an organization, I dive into product market fit and I'm like, why are you building what you're building? When I just scratch a little bit there, it's all intuitive.
Yeah.
And there's been no real methodology applied to what are we building and why?
Mm.
Who are the stakeholders that we're building for? What are their tasks, pains, gains?
Yeah.
What can we do to relieve it? How do we test the hypothesis?
Mm.
Most of the people are taking their money, their pension, their family's money or VC's money and building things that aren't even market relevant.
Mm.
So they generally have good ideas or good intent, but you know, there's very little substance behind the why and the validation of the why.
Mm.
And I think that's the first critical step.
Yeah.
The startups that are enterprise ready have somehow majestically got that right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they've probably, that's where I would accredit a incubator or an accelerator or a university that has good mentorship that has enabled them to solve that. And when they hit that product market fit, you see that rapid spike.
Mm.
Then it's about, because it's like everyone wants to be a founder. Everyone thinks the startup journey is amazing. It's really difficult and it's really tough. And will test you at every level. And that's why there's such a high failure rate. Because yes, you might get product market fit, but now, as you would know, the next set of challenges kick in, which is how do we scale this?
Mm-hmm.
So you need more money to make sure that you're scaling your tech to meet the increasing demand or the regional applications, whatever it may be, to raise money, to make sure you have the right skills, which you scale sustainably as you grow, okay? To ensure you don't burn out your existing teams, but also to make sure that you don't have brand reputational damage once you do get an enterprise opportunity. So I've put these assessments in place to validate, A, how investable are you? And what are you investing money for? That tethers directly to the technology assessment, which is to say, these are the phases of what you should be leveraging from a technology perspective to hit the dream. This is what your product market fit should look like, but that's more of a consultative process with them. And these are the skills and strategies where you're strong, where you're weak, what you need to beef up. Technology and build to last, that's biggest portion of your ask financially.
It is, isn't it?
So that you can do it sustainably.
Yeah.
Once they tick those three boxes, and I just had it with a startup now, we got an amazing opportunity with Changi Airport Group, and we've weaved one of the startups that is ready, that has scored high across all of those dimensions, to introduce them as a differentiator into an enterprise opportunity with Huawei, okay, which is the essence of our program, is how do we take it from startup to scale up, which is why we do what we do.
Mm.
Obviously, they become evangelists for our technology.
Yeah.
But can never introduce a startup like that to an opportunity of that grand scale if they're not ready, because you're doomed to fail.
Yeah.
So my best attempt in the last year and a half of working in this ecosystem has been centered around the sanity must prevail in how do I decode this?
Yeah.
It's like I'm almost, I like to use the term fleshing out the startup DNA and then leveraging that DNA to do predictive analysis.
To see where it goes. How do you incorporate things like, because part of what I've seen on the journey to overnight success, air quotes, definitely, right? Which is why it's just sort of one of those ones of, you know, everyone who's been in the game is like, yeah, absolutely. See, getting close to your decade, how are you going? Sometimes it takes two. But I saw it's a stamina game at one level.
And even if it was within the four or 5 year period, the founders that I've seen that have done that, it wasn't just that 4 or 5 years. It was actually all of the stuff before that that led them to start that business, to be ready at that point.
Precisely.
To do that.
Yeah, exactly. So there's, you know, often, you know, quite a big, you know,
run-up.
Exactly. You know, in that. And then there's, you know, the spotlight moment and everyone's, hence why the laughter is like, right. And which then also for me, like one of the pieces is, you know, in that, because there really is this journey that seems to be, you know, where is the maturity of the thinking in that team's resilience? Because sometimes, you know, there's those cycles.
Yeah.
And just.
That is a tough one. So I think I've thought about that a lot. And it's so interesting. I've heard different perspectives on this. I'm not sure what perspective I hold. I think the make or break comes down to the founder team and their resilience for sure. Can you coach and prepare someone that isn't resilient? In principle, yes. In reality, I can't say with confidence because I haven't done it to the point of someone finding unicorn status. The only unicorn I have worked with was one I was consulting to, then joined. Those founders were resilient, hardcore South African, alpha male, resilient, but had cut their teeth in the tech space for decades before. So,
And they'd cut themselves in some pretty tough environments before they got into the tech.
And found success launching other business. So they're like mentally ready.
Yeah.
I look at the startup that we just introduced to the airport opportunity. There's very specific traits within that founder. So very humble, very soft, but very focused, very dedicated, and I suspect resilient because within 2 years, he's got 30 construction companies that he's solving for. So it's not just the resilience of the founder. It's that first 10 hires, which I think is so critical because it becomes a core team resilience and who you surround yourself with. So I've been thinking a lot to try and answer your question. Having built out the Build to Last report and identifying the skills that are needed, the part that I've been thinking a lot about is, do I need to bake in a personality profile assessment to understand the DNA of the persona that is the founder and the first follower or followers, where the gaps are, and then outside of just the job type, what is the personality profile that would be a best fit for their culture? To help solidify that core unit to be resilient as a whole, to get them from the 10 to the 50.
Yeah.
But I don't have the answer for that yet.
Yeah.
And it's a good question. I have heard, I've had someone on the podcast who uses AI. You speak and answer questions and the AI is measuring 3 million markers in your voice, not what you say or how you say it, to pick up depression. And she mentioned, and I still haven't got the papers, that she was able to use the technology to listen to a founder pitch and pick up which founders would be successful and which wouldn't. But I find that a little bit difficult to believe just from a pitch you could identify that because the question is centered around resilience, which is what you need for that founder's journey.
Yeah.
I think the Americans get it because they tend to not take you seriously. If you go into a pitch and they ask you how many times have you failed and you say none, they're less likely to be confident in you than the guy that has failed.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah. Scar tissue. There was a wonderful model by a gentleman called Professor Peter Robertson who did his research was based on, weirdly enough, came out of the Mayo Clinic. So actually came out of the biological sciences. and cybernetics.
Nice.
As a combination. And
sorry, what is the Mayo Clinic? Excuse my ignorance.
It's a very sophisticated medical research institution in the US.
Okay.
And so going back to integrating things from Conrad Lawrence on what creates safe attachment. So it was quite a beautiful multidimensional one. But what I've liked about it in this space of being able to look at teams is it tests quite a few dimensions on what creates stability and an ability to adapt and the different perspectives that's needed so you can see if there's gaps.
Mm,
mm. And I found that one a useful, very practically useful tool for being able to go and talk with the teams on where they're at and why. And at the more sort of gentle personal one, it's almost like, are they willing to talk about their moments of darkness or their periods of darkness and how they've got through them? Because it may not be that it was because they'd already had a startup success, but if they've shown that ability to come back from some of the inevitable shitty pieces that happen in life, they've got that ability to recover and keep moving rather than collapsing under the weight. I mean, like, you know, when your comment there about, you know, yeah, and then your ego was destroyed, right? I mean, mine's certainly been taken apart more than once.
Yeah. So important.
But it's
in retrospect.
Yeah.
Going through it's horrible.
Horrible. Horrible, but I do think I'm a better human being.
Yeah.
And a more able person in helping others to succeed as a consequence of the fact that, you know, the good old ego has been, you know, well bashed aside.
Yeah, and more humble.
Oh, yeah. Hugely.
Yeah. I think it's so good to be humbled.
Mm.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, while you were speaking now, I was thinking about one of the things I'm trying to do now is get to a point where I can, in real time, pick up the soft signals and quantify and predict a black swan event, and whether or not the resilience can be preluded so that you can almost have at least a window of preparation to say with a high degree of certainty, this is about a hit and this is how you need to deal with it, and provide coaching, because I think that's the key as well, that mentorship and coaching, the good founders and the successful founders all have strong mentors and strong advisors.
Yeah, it's that bigger team.
Yeah, you have to have that.
Yeah.
You have to lean on people to, because it's impossible to know it all. And you might not be a resilient founder, but you could be a good leader. And the only reason you don't have resilience is because you haven't failed yet. Do you want to fail? No. Should you? Maybe. But ideally, that comes with a lot of pain and consequence. So if you don't have to because you have a good support structure, then maybe that is a way. I think there's a book here maybe that is
waiting
to be.
There you go. You're waiting for you to get written. There was something in what you were just saying there that, you know, a little bit of the back of the head was going like, oh, this is an interesting one, because let's see if it can come back out, because there's a space around the you know, the bigger ecosystem of support and advice. And one of the founders that I was mentoring a couple of years ago was at a Chamber of Commerce awards night last night. And
which one?
Australia.
Okay.
Anyhow, you know, he comes and sits down. And I hadn't seen him in a while. And he's been through, you know, getting, you know, into being listing in two different countries, and it's just going like, you know, and what you were there then. It was like, oh my God, sometimes you forget things that you've. It's like, oh, absolutely brilliant. I go, well, you know, glad.
He was saying that what you had helped him with actually
was just something that was, and it was. It's wonderful because there's a journey, and, you know, often we're involved for part of a journey, not necessarily, you know, all of it. To have realized that something that was part and parcel was super, super useful. But the reason why I think he's coming into mind right now is, you know, it wasn't his first rodeo. And there was a level of mindfulness of how he was choosing to balance looking after his team, but also making sure his family was okay.
Mm. So important.
And that this bigger sense of care and balance, because, you know, as a founding team, you know, moving through this, and as someone who's working and mentoring, and be it through the roles that we have you know, startup ecosystems or as advisors, or even in some cases with some of the VC funds on like how can you spot the right ones? Mm. Is I actually think there's a very practical, very, very simple indicator. Is are people willing to actually go and take a couple of hours out on a regular basis or a days out on a regular basis to actually consider how we would respond to a black swan? Hmm. I mean, it's very, I mean, it's,
I like that.
It is so simple.
I like that a lot, actually. I've never thought of that.
Yeah.
There's something there.
Mm.
Like when they do cybersecurity testing, they have a red team and a blue team. So, mm. You have a black swan team and you put a team through a worst case scenario and see how they deal with it.
Mm.
That could be invaluable.
Yeah.
I like that.
And you can pick up different sorts of combinations of situations and events. Because when I come from Tasmania,
mm.
and I've always had a giggle when people talk about black swans, because the only swans we have in Tasmania are black.
Oh, really?
You know, they're black. So we have a black swan event. It's like, oh, really? We got a whole bunch of those sitting, you know, floating down there on the river.
Yeah.
And it's just, and I know the phrase comes from something that we didn't expect and that our worldview defined it out of possibility. And to me, the black swan is like, yeah, all you have to do is change your definition of possibility and there's something new.
That,
here are the black swans swimming on the river. They're completely there. And this willingness to actually go and say, what parts of my worldview or my combination of events am I really uncomfortable looking at?
Mm.
So then how do we create a structure, be it different teams or the same leadership team, deliberately going in there? And the most simplistic one that I found from like that really soft signal is if they're not willing to put time into exploring it.
Mm. Then they're going to be a victim to it.
Yeah.
There was another term that I heard recently. So there's black swan, but then it's something jellyfish. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. It was like, I want to, it's something jellyfish. And it was from a futurist named Craig Wing, who uh-huh. I interviewed a week ago. And it's uh-huh. the second time I've sat with him. And he likes to backcast to create the perfect future, leveraging mm-hmm. what you got.
Yeah.
So it's more about shaping your reality.
Mm.
And the jellyfish analogy is centered around because of the increasing ocean temperatures,
mm-hmm.
there's more jellyfish. And mm-hmm. I think he referenced in a specific part of a certain country. And those jellyfish are slowly but surely clogging up the filtration systems that feed a nuclear plant and is causing this catastrophe to kind of almost happen. So it's not as severe as a black swan. It's, you've got all the signals. It's there. It's building. It's like the climate crisis, right? It's the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting. And I mean, we've spoken a lot about VCs and founders, but I'd like to know, and I want to come back and straw man the ESG thing as well. Okay. But you're working with corporates. So the principle applies, right?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose maybe even more so. I would say maybe corporates are a bit more relaxed because it's got a bit more room to flex. But you going in and you helping to prepare leadership
mm-hmm.
groups for this type of contingency thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how do you approach it? What is your methodology? Where do you come in? Like, how do you help structure an organization to think like this?
I take it in three stages. First one is with a very senior team. And it, from the outside, it looks like workshops.
Mm.
But what I'm actually, and I'm running it as a social test. On what they're prepared to think, what combinations of things. So I've got a set of about 150 future casts.
What is a future cast?
This could happen.
Okay. So a scenario.
But very, very, very granular
okay.
type things. So it's, which then gets, okay, so we're creating, well, so these combinations come together, that combinations. Okay. Well, wait a sec. Both are happening. How are you operating? So it provides a way of test, of seeing how willing they are to even step in to explore futures that have different combinations to the standard story they've been told by their strategy team. or by, you know, their favorite set of advisors. Because my intention is not to go in there and repeat the standard story. That doesn't add anything. It doesn't, you know, to what we've been talking about. It doesn't allow us to see beyond the edges, because the interesting stuff's beyond the edge, beyond the edges. On that one, and that from my point of view, is from a point of view of practice, it's a test to see whether that thinking's even possible. Can they step in and do it? Because if they can't, I already know which pathway they're on. And
what would be a good example of a future cost scenario that you'd curveball a specific market vertical with?
Literally, but we have 150. We have 150. Sometimes and it's literally go pick. Every single one of those, every single one of the things that are in the set are absolutely scientifically valid as possibilities, as potentials. But most people only take one potential and look at that and then dismiss it. And it's like, okay, so what we create a workshop process. So people are taking sets of these together and then doing what, you know, in Oxford scenarios processes, creating what possible futures could come out of that. And then therefore, what would we actually do about it? Now, that second one about what would actually do about it is in step two.
So, and yeah, excuse me, yeah, as I try and go through this, because it's very interesting. So you've created 150 permutations of future cost events. They pick one or more. Then in real time, it's like a C-suite group or a functional group within the organization. And you say, okay, deal with it.
Exactly.
And well, what's your next move?
Exactly. Okay. The first one is actually usually around, what would this actually mean? It's the sense making.
Yeah.
How do you process? How do you pull it together? You know, can you even formulate? Because this, you know, to like what creates power of the thing is people get so channeled into what they think should be. Often they can't even literally take on that piece of data and go, this is valid in the world. Here's the swan. The swan's in front of you. Like, you know, swans fly in, right? They're big birds. They make noises. They're very graceful. But, you know, they don't just go puff of smoke appear like some magician's thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's, to your point about signals, that, you know, there's things that are leading in if we're willing to pay attention. So this allows, we run this one, and it's primarily, can they make sense? Can they integrate? And can then they start thinking about what the implications are? That doing those three things is actually incredibly heavy cognitive load on people.
And do you give them a time constraint?
Of course.
So what, like half a day or?
Usually half a day.
Okay. And they have to come up with a full responsive strategy that they would implement?
No, they just simply have to be able to integrate and be intelligent about what would need to be thought about.
Okay.
I've found over the years, I used to do it with a super high intensity stress version before in my younger years. And then what I realized was what I was doing was I was creating a structure that triggered fear dynamic, which doesn't create for deep thinking.
It's not constructive.
Yeah. So I've had to deliberately go, like, given what I know about neuroscience, how do I design this so they stay high performing individuals with discipline on the topic to not run away and go into
panic
and dramas and in there. But with a time constraint, because one of our resources in reality is time.
Gotcha.
So that's always part and parcel of it. So that's half day with, you know, a functional group or a leadership group, depending on scale of organization. Sometimes with founder groups, which can be quite interesting.
Sure.
You know, two on that one. That gives enough data to sit down with whoever the sponsoring executive and to go, this is how the team's capacity to respond is.
And do you... The 150 future cost scenarios are general, or do you segment them for a vertical, or do you keep it general on purpose?
I keep it general on purpose because often what people talk about are black swans are simply events that somebody, to what we were talking
about. You
don't
even know it's relevant to your industry. It's coming from the right field.
Over there.
Yeah.
And it's like me sitting, being able to sit there and call my mom up and go, I reckon this is going to, like, you know, I'm no genius on this. There must be plenty of other people. But I knew this. I had the wide vision to see the signal to incorporate it into what I did. So I keep it. Certain industries, as sometimes there's some fun ones to go in, put in particular. But the wide signals is often
more
where
relevant.
Where the weakness is, and therefore creates the relevance by deliberately bringing it in. So that's step one. Step two is going, okay, so now we're getting, you know, we're widening our field of reference in here. Now, as we start pulling these scenarios, what is that? How do we? What choices are we going to make? Which ones are we going to back? Which ones do we want to not be back in because the consequences of those ones are so horrible?
Mm. Because, and do you let them free flow to map that out, or do you give them some, things?
Structure.
Okay.
On that one. But the core outcome of that process is, okay, these are the things we really need to be doubling down on, because several of these scenarios go, this will be powerful. And oh boy, now we thought through those, we should need to be doing something to avoid. Because often people underinvest in the avoidance tactics as well. You know, it's a bit like when you go, you know, I should be doing more exercise. And then just going, actually, if I went and set my alarm, went to bed half an hour earlier and got up half an hour earlier, you know, I would probably be able to go and get a good walk in the morning.
Yeah.
So
simple yet effective. Yeah.
Yeah. Simple and effective. I go for simple and effective because I think there's a lot where we create complexity that doesn't add a lot of value. Gotcha. I can complexify stuff. I got a good brain. I got a systems brain.
You know, but the point is that in a crisis, you want people to be high performing, as you mentioned, and to be constructive, not panic at the disco.
Exactly. And when they've been through this sort of process, they're building the socialized skill with each other to operate in that way.
Gotcha.
To not go into that immediate, you know, here in a crisis panic.
Mm.
To then be, and then because the second stage is working through, well, how would you do and what would you do? That gives that whole role playing type capacity to forward think into what would be possible, how they could respond. And then the third one is like, okay, so if, you know, workshops are great. So then now what are you going to do in real life? Because it's the thinking process is the first layer, the experiential process is the second. And the third one is actually go create. Is actually go do it. You know, and that's the place where the commitment to see forward and say, you know what, there's some of these things that will, you know, to talking about that short-term, long-term thing. Some of these ones are, you can see this slow-moving object.
Mm.
But the question is, given there is a slow-moving object, are you going to ignore it, or are you going to deliberately do small things progressively so that you're in the right place for said slow-moving object, whatever it is, positive or negative, to be able to be in the right place for it? And that takes a systems thinking and a set of discipline that not many teams are prepared to commit to.
Agreed. As you're talking, I'm thinking of two scenarios. So one, I remember seeing COVID unfold in Asia, being in South Africa, being like, have you seen that crazy thing happening in Asia? You know, not worried about it.
Yeah.
No one was preparing for it. It was an Asian thing. And then it swept the globe and boom, we know how that story ended. Then I think of the Suez Canal story where the ship got stuck.
Yeah.
And I remember speaking to someone I know that was running the comms for a big shipping company.
Mm-hmm.
And a few days after it happened, only then were they kicking into gear like, oh, wait, this is actually going to impact us. And I'm like, are you telling me that you guys in your vertical dealing with shipping didn't quantify? And then the panic was kicking in. How do we notify? Because now all these deliveries and there's this knock-on effect all the way down. So that made me think quite a lot about just how, generally speaking, we in autopilot with very little strategic or systems thinking. So I find it fascinating that you're running these workshops. Do you, they say never waste a good crisis. Is part of your workshop, outside of dealing with the crisis, figuring out how to leverage it?
Absolutely. Because the power of a crisis, I mean, if you go back to the old etymology of it, it's that turning point side of it. And, you know, I will think back just, you know, to, you know, take it out of the theoretical and into the practical is, you know, in that moment of crisis, it's like, you know, at least I could say for myself and be curious for you, when I hit that point of having to let the ego go, suddenly a whole bunch of other stuff opened up. A whole bunch of other stuff. And, you know, but it was crisis. You know, it was not a fun place to be. But in that space, suddenly there's a whole stack of other things that become possible because we have to let go of that old rule or that old belief or that old construct. And therefore, what could we do instead? what would be better to preserve? What would be more powerful if we did?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's not so much like go out seeking crises, but they are, I have found that they are incredibly powerful places for the next level of transformation.
Interesting. I yeah. love that. That's quite profound.
Yeah.
Huh. If prepared for properly, it could be the make or break for your entity, organization. Mm. Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And a bit of it's the willingness in that, and this is where I suspect when some of the founding team or some of the advisors have been through their own equivalent long dark night of the soul to have had some lived experience that of it helps. Because otherwise the way, at least I was brought up in this, the sort of school systems and the business systems, it was like you're only as good as your last success.
Mm, that's actually the opposite.
And yet, you know, then you hit that point where that's not working anymore, and then there's nothing, and there's no skill and capacity to go, well, okay, but it's this other time in my life, and just judging from the way you're smiling at it, you're going like, yeah, actually, this is actually where the spaces open up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now what's possible?
Yeah.
You know, if you take the sewers, what happened in the sewers, and you go like, okay, it's not the first time the sewers are shut down, you know, thinking history. Like most things have a historical, you know, like history. Very rare that something is happening for the first time.
What do they say? History doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme.
yeah, exactly. And just go like, well, like, so given that, like, well, how would we do? Like, how would businesses respond, have chosen to respond differently in that one? What else opened up? What other sorts of possibilities opened up as a consequence? Lots normally. Different ways of relating to customers, different ways of engaging with suppliers.
Moving goods.
Yeah.
You just needed to get some chartered flights.
Exactly. You know, what are actually really key supplies, and then how would we move those around given that?
Yeah. Why are we importing so much and not creating? You know, where's that contingency?
Exactly. Yeah. It opens up a whole stack more.
So just to round it off, so you run these workshops, you prepare leadership teams before I dive into the ESG part of it, but you give them these scenarios, you give them frameworks in which to test them against the scenarios within a time constraint, so you then give them a real world application.
Yep.
What else?
And then, like I said, the third one is, okay, so what are you actually willing to do? The most pragmatic analogy I have for this one is that, you know, the first one is a bit like, you know, if we saw a leadership team as a group of artists creating something that they've not created together before.
Like that, yeah.
You know, the first part of any powerful artwork is like, what's the conceptual vision? What is this about? I mean, it's very nebulous, but if you can't get that, then there's nothing to create. Then the second one is you start, you know, if you're a visual artist, you know, you're starting getting the sketch, the form, the of what it might be, what are the different dimensions, and pulling it together, and then becomes the hard yak of actually going and creating it, of the building, and going, okay, this and what next, and okay, well, this, you know, we thought that was going to be, that didn't work, okay, but back to the unicorn point, if this is the point we're aiming for, what other pathway will help us get there? And my experience has been in that dimension, things happen far faster than people expect.
Got you.
Which is not what they're anticipating, but that's half the fun. But it's that willingness to go now, have to be in action. What's being done? What part of reality are we testing? Which hypothesis can we take forward? Or which questions do we need to ask to find out that next bit of the pathway?
It's very design thinking orientated. Okay.
Well, design thinking comes from art.
Yeah.
Packaged up so that it's corporate safe.
Nice. I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah. Talk to me a bit about your ESG Council and the work you're doing there.
The ESG Council was set up so that organizations, large and small, could access practical roadmaps to accelerate their journey on sustainability. We looked at it, the systems thinking brain, along with a couple of other colleagues from other parts of life. And so the issue with ESG is not that we don't know what to do, is that it feels so big and overwhelming. So we do, most people do that when it's big and overwhelming, they go, let me go do something I can understand. None of us like feeling incompetent. But the reality is all these things are well built out fields, but they're just not fields that we're familiar with. So what we've done at the Institute is put together roadmaps with 10 other organizations so that we can go, okay, is it strategically the right decision to be an observer? You know, for some organizations, that may be an authentically appropriate strategic response. Are we at the stage of being a pledger, which means that we've seen there are some stakeholder demands for action, but we're not seeing a need to change business models and that. And therefore, the appropriate response would be different based on what's, you know, if you just even think of those two particular typologies there. The third one is organizations that are saying, okay, for us to be viable in the future, we need to be a complier. We need to be ready for the sorts of things that are likely to be happening in terms of, be it around carbon and greenhouse gas, be it around materialization, be it around in the S, for example, in community impact, in governance, a whole series of elements in governance. Are we going to be fit for the future that's coming at us based on our capacity to change? You know, and that's from a point of view of, if you're thinking about, is someone investable? And the resilience going forward. Now, that's a very strong basic resilience position to be in and go like, we are going to be ready for what's coming at us.
Got you. Let me straw man it a bit.
Yeah.
Lots of controversy around ESG, I think. And I'm keen to get your response on some of these points I've heard, because I'm by no means the expert or hold a view. Just have seen people making noise. So you have some people that are calling out ESG and saying that you've got like big oil that's in the top 10, but then Tesla would be kind of weighed further down the list. How does that stack up and make any logical sense, you know, when it comes to ESG rankings? I think you also have a lot of negative perceptions around ESG versus real world KPIs and profit making. And the two don't stack up, which is why people tend to shy away from, you know, the former. So what are your thoughts around that, and how do you kind of shape thinking on that?
Let's parse up some of the problem spaces on that one. The first piece is that the term ESG is very loosely defined, which to me is part of the problem. So when I wrote Greenside, it was literally to be super pragmatic and go, okay, in environment, you know, are you looking at the following eight things? Because fundamentally, very few people half the reason why we think someone else is greenwashing is they care about something different.
Yeah, different KPIs.
Yeah. And therefore, you're not caring about, my worldview, you're greenwashing because you're not caring about mine. That's like, now, let's be clean about I'm caring about that, you're caring about that. Okay, different. We could be mutually respectful. And I can still say, I choose to, in terms of my supplier base or my customer base, have a filter that says I prefer organizations operating on a different profile.
For those that don't know what greenwashing is?
Greenwashing is when basically you go and pretend to be green and you're not. So these are the sorts of things where you do one token project. You know, you go and clean up a beach and say that we're really good, but actually your production plans are producing an awful lot of waste that's damaging. That's the level of integrity between the marketed statements and the reality has got a significant gap. You know, the old fashioned thing, we just call people liars. As some of my friends in marketing would say, no, they're just over marketing. I'm just going like, substance is substance. So part of the thing when people are talking about, you know, Tesla or oil and gas, is that the people who've created a particular index have their own internal weighting on what elements they're prioritizing. So that lack of transparency is actually what the issue is, rather than anything else.
Okay.
So if you've got a super high weight on, are you an organization that has high consultation of communities? Some of the oil and gas and the mining companies are quite good on that because they've had so much shit given to them over the years for good reason. Yeah. They have to. So they're actually, in some levels, can be perceived to be relatively, based on the scoring system, relatively good.
Got you.
That's not Tesla's strong point.
Yeah.
It's got other metrics. So when we wrote GreenSight and did the research that's behind GreenSight, it was like, well, what are the most common things so that we can be clear on what is our actual profile against these and therefore have constructive conversations rather than dismissive conversations with each other. So, you know, that's a significant part and parcel of, you know, this whole, you know, is it fiction? It's like, well, we're talking about different things. So let's actually end up defining it and talk about the same things.
Mm.
Then we can be constructive on
us. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. On that one, and it's not the he says, she says crap.
So there's no one ESG index.
What's happened is people have created their own. And so when we set the Institute up, it was to say, let's create a transparent structure.
Where weightings are applicable to verticals or...
And you can choose your own. I mean, in the same way that with a bank, they have their own credit scoring thing, but there are some standard profiles that people know and acknowledge as these have high correlations to performance.
Gotcha.
And that keeps it clean. It keeps it non-judgmental. And you as an investor or as a customer or as a supplier can go and say, okay, we'd like to see your profile. And it can be agreed to be released so that there's a transparency in that. And then if I say that, okay, for me and what we're doing and on the value chain we're in, it's super important to have organizations that are scoring very, very high on what they're doing in biodiversity and their care for that may be completely irrelevant to a different value chain.
Gotcha.
But I'm not judging the other one negatively for it. I'm being clean and transparent about what my priorities are.
Can people still abuse that?
One of the things I found over the years, if people want to abuse shit, they will. So I make no apologies for the mere fact that, you know, we are quite creative of working our way around corners.
Yeah.
It is a human truth. But I do think the transparency on it, and the level of agreement on what some of these things are, does take some of the noise out of the system.
Mm.
Each of the elements that we've included in the core parts of the construct in the ESG's governance structure all come back to things that are independently researched to be highly correlated with high performance. So you don't have to like it, but the science does suggest that it correlates to high performance.
Mm-hmm.
So like one that often, you know, gets a reaction is this whole idea talking about pay equity.
Mm.
So much, there's such a deep body of research across so many countries that just simply says the more equitable pay is for comparable work, the higher performing the organization tends to be.
Mm,
the more likely it's going to be in the top quartile rather than the bottom quartile.
Interesting.
And it's just going like, you don't have to like it, but this is actually what the data suggests. Sure, yeah. So, you know, oh, it costs us money. It's like, well, actually you're transfer charging between one group or externalizing a cost to another. The more transparent we are about some of those things, and the cleaner the conversation gets.
Gotcha.
And then as a business, we can be clean internally. We've got a common alignment on it. And then one of the pieces that is hitting more and more for businesses, we're seeing the early signs of it now in Asia, is where organizations are either looking at their customer base or their supplier base and saying, we don't just care about you giving us an appropriate price for this, i.e. the financial. We're actually looking at the other things you're doing because that shows up on our scorecard too.
Mm.
You know, and that term for that in the environment space is called scope 3.
Got you.
I mean, that
makes a lot of sense. Mm. And I think that's smart to make it relative. Like you said, if people want to bullshit, they'll always find a way to short the system.
Yeah.
But the principle is to drive the right behavior and align the KPIs, because I find more mm-hmm. often than not, it's a KPI thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so like when you talk about like weak but strong signals.
Yeah.
So each year we do a state of sustainability survey and then produce a report around it. Our next one's coming out next week. And one of the lead indicators, of course, is to what degree do you actually have a alignment, B, understanding, and C, KPIs aligned to these sorts of things in the organization. Because in reality is if you don't have those three things, there's going to be no action.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Which means you might have a fantastic pledge of saying we want to be, you know, net zero. This is great. But if you're doing none of that, I know there's no motion.
Yeah.
And therefore the ability of the organization might be marketing it strongly, but they're not even going to be able to be a complier and ready for the future, much less be someone who you could say from a business point of view is likely to be a successful transformer, i.e. truly contributing into those metrics and developing capacity and therefore value creation around it, much less the more advanced players, which are defining whole new business models.
Hmm. Seems pretty obvious, but I think if it was, you probably wouldn't need to go in and do the work that you do. So, I mean, just to loop back to the kind of consulting you do and mentorship, it's really just to come in and help companies align at a strategic level, at a futurist thinking level, at a strategic planning level when it comes to dealing with events, and aligning their ESG KPIs with where the market or legislation is going.
Well, where the market legislation and also when they start thinking through what kind of future do they want to be creating. So it may not be market, it may not be legislation, it may be a very conscious, you know what, there's that game and there's that game, and we don't want to be actually the one contributing to that game. We want to be contributing to this game. And, you know, that's a very conscious choice.
And I suppose you can only make that choice if you understand the options and the consequence of those options, because the one on the left has a very specific picture. And if everyone's going down that path, it doesn't matter how much money you're making, you can't breathe or eat money.
Well, and particularly now money is digital. It's even, at least in the good old days, you know, when it was paper, you could use it for something else.
Maybe smoke it or something.
Now it's completely digital. And so, you know, the work with the leadership teams is around that, because I've just found over the years, it's very hard if the top teams aren't pushing, you know, they're not opening the pathways. And then we run a lot of programs that are around, and this is when it's beyond me as sort of the individual mentor, and it's the organization's support on helping the rest of organization, i.e. the people, to be able to move forward and step into these new spaces. Because what I found over the years is that we get so used to being put in X box and being told this is the way we're allowed to make a decision, that when, as leadership teams start opening up, unless we consciously change the rules and make it really visible and give people the opportunity to try different things on for size, they're not going to do anything different. They're going to go, I got my KPI. I know what happened last year when I tried something a little different. It whacked me. I'm not moving. So that learning and development side of things becomes equally important as the second, you know, is like if you've got two legs, you've got to have both of them in action to be able to move forward.
So important, because often that strategic thinking at the top doesn't filter to the bottom.
Yeah.
Which creates this disjointedness within an organization. And I've made that mistake in corporate where the KPI, I don't align to the KPI, or I don't shape the KPI to what I actually need to do, because you get an opportunity to do that. I suppose they'll always try and ground you against the North Star. So then you're pulling in different directions. I like the mention of the training and upskilling part as well. I think that there's a huge question mark and challenge there for a lot of your learning and development professionals, HR professionals, looking at the workforce, looking at the rate of knots that everything's moving. How do you and where do you try and get their attention? Because I've set up a training and enablement division to get people to focus and complete a module.
Hard work.
To certify. Again, the only way it worked is when it was aligned to their KPIs.
Yeah.
100%.
And it's like, I remember, you know, my sort of realizing how important this piece was many moons ago, it being given it like, oh, Joanne, and would you also do this kind of project? And a guy like, this is cool, and going and doing it. But one has X amount of bandwidth. And that meant that one of the other KPIs
suffered.
you know, and that had been agreed. You know, that there was this trade-off. But when it hit the end of year performance review, guess what I got whacked for?
Yeah.
And it was like, after that, it was like, I'm just going like, I'm noticing my own reaction on it. And I'm going like, and I'm just, you know.
And you probably nailed it and did great work. And everyone was like, this is amazing, but it wasn't your KPI.
Precisely. And the, even the fact was because the KPI system hadn't been updated to match the agreement that we had, because of course you've got different bosses and multi-matrixy dimensions pulling us in the squillion dimension on it. And nearly everyone, it's like, it was so brutal. It was just...
soul destroying.
Completely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so no one in their right mind will step off that beaten path more than once.
Yeah.
And so if we'd really, like from a, you know, again, the weak signals conversation of... If we're putting any strategic change through, you know, be it saying we're wanting to up our movement on ESG, for example, or we're seeing a different way we need to be relating to our technologies and digitization, you know, to pick another one. I mean, they're getting closer and closer as topics. And we're not doing anything to change the way our people think, their KPIs and the conversations we have with them leaders. Why on earth do we expect any differences in behavior?
Yeah.
Not happening.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about this at a corporate level. Mm. I think it matters at a government level as well. And I find most governments have lost the plot. You know, I look at something that really inspired me is to better understand the Chinese culture. I kind of took a deep dive into how they have what they call their five-year strategy or five-year plan. I forget the name. And the way it works is they plan for it quite a few years in advance, where at a regional level, they roll up what is it that we need to do.
Yeah.
And then it starts at the bottom, it rolls up and rolls up and it rolls up. And obviously at the top level, it gets aligned to an overarching vision. But then when they sign off on it, everyone down the value chain is held accountable. That becomes your KPI for the next 5 years. And, it's crazy because I think, you know, of my country, there's just no accountability. There's no KPIs. It's just, it feels like a free for all. Everyone's out to lunch.
Yeah.
You know, and you can see the countries that have strong policy and strong KPI management are leapfrogging within our lifetime. You can see the leapfrog in development, in infrastructure, in societal behavior, in societal health. And that principle applies at a corporate level, at a government level, at a startup level. So yeah, I see a lot of value in that. And I think it's been a very enlightening discussion and definitely keen to learn more. You've stimulated my creative thinking on the scenario workshops that you run. And I would encourage anyone that's watching this or listening to this to reach out and engage, because I think that I don't know. I haven't heard of teams doing that, and it resonates quite a lot with me to know that you're out there catalyzing that type of workshop, because that would help when the pawpaw does hit the fan. that they know exactly how to deal with it without you know, completely breaking down.
And it's what I found is that when we're prepared to go and face those sorts of things, they become infinitely less scarier.
Yeah.
And
you almost go in with confidence because you kind of have tested your team, the resolve, the methodology. It's like anything, discipline, practice, rehearsal.
It's like if we were a sports team, we'd be out doing rehearsals, we'd be trying things out. You know, we'd be learning different game plays.
Yeah.
We'd be going, well, if we stretch these rules, how would we need to be playing the game? And the scenario type workshops allow people to do that, you know, in deliberately the safe petri dish of a workshop rather than saying, okay, now let's go and experiment on your P&L. You know, how many billions can we write off today? Yeah. We don't need to, because the scenarios create that soft predictive environment to sense make and go, okay. And then, you know, to the wisdom of the structures that you're developing, is like, where are the signals that can give us that wide angle?
Yeah, and the converse of, you know, even not so much even the testing of it on the P&L, but being victim to it, because testing it, at least you can pull the plug and take the loss. Yeah. Being victim to it could wipe out your P&L because you just were never ready.
Yeah.
You no longer exist. That's it.
Yeah.
Cheers, big ears. Thanks for coming. You didn't plan.
Yeah.
Good. Well, thank you so much. I really, I do appreciate your time with us, and I could sit and discuss this with you for a few more hours. I would like to, at some point, you know, maybe even go into another session where we deep dive those scenarios. It definitely intrigued me. And your book is out. So, you know, quick shout out for your book, and where can people source it, and, you know, what value would it add to them?
Yeah. So the book is GreenSight, the Sustainability Guide for Company Directors, written for the senior audience. So C-suite and boards, to what are the constructs that we're dealing with in that zone of business responsibility, simplifying the alphabet soup of sustainability, strategically, what are your choices against those different model, the topologies that I spoke about? And then thirdly, a very, very practical guide on if you want to start rolling this out, how do you go and set up your top level of accountabilities across different parts of the C-suite so you can get into action? And we wrote the book this way for a very pragmatic reason, is if it saves you 6 months in your journey, that 6 months is tremendously valuable.
Yeah.
And that gives you access into the tool. It's available on not just bookstores nearby, but very usefully, you can get it on Amazon and some of the other online bookstores like Book Depository.
Nice.
You know, or you can reach out to me at joanne@joanneflynn.com on my name.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, and best of luck, and keep doing the good work that you're doing. I think it's important.
Thank you for having me and for a brilliant conversation.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.